Hey folks, well thank you for coming back for lunch. I want to thank Microsoft also for helping out with the lunch, and Kyra and Cindy from Santa Clara Law School helping out and getting everything ready. Great job. Thank you, everybody. This last panel, we're calling it the implications of moving from crowd to cloud, and it's about the implications of cloud computing. And I honestly, I don't have a clue what that is.
You'll learn.
Let's hope. And the idea is that, you know, popping up in news stories every day are writers talking about some policy implications of cloud computing. Members of Congress are asking folks back in Washington, well, what is cloud computing and what's the policy implications? Why is it a paradigm shift? And we thought that since we're out here, you know, in the middle of the marketplace, we thought we'd ask this question and try to figure out what exactly is cloud computing, what the policy implications are, and what we expect members of Congress to start hearing about very shortly in the context of cloud computing. So we asked, we looked around and we found what we thought was one of the most prominent cloud computing companies out there, Salesforce.com, and we asked their general counsel, David Shell Hayes, to kind of give us an introduction of what cloud computing was, what the issues are and the policy implications. And then also have a few folks to talk about, the most obvious of which are kind of the law enforcement and litigation issues. So with that, I want to introduce the general counsel of Salesforce.com, David Shell Hayes. And if any of you don't know who Salesforce is, David can tell you.
But I don't think anybody wants a sales pitch, but I'm happy to give it.
So let me introduce David.
Thank you, Tim. Before I start, let me introduce my fellow panelists. Matt Perella, who's on my left, is an assistant U.S. attorney with the Department of Justice here in the Northern District of California in San Jose. Jim Dempsey is the Vice President of Public Policy for the Center for Democracy and Technology, and he's currently the sole resident of the San Francisco office, I think.
We're about to double in size
about to double
in 2 weeks.
Size. Growth is good. Let me try to give you what I think a definition of cloud computing is. And like anybody else, I went to Google first and I said, what is cloud computing? And Google gave me back an answer that I thought was interesting. The first entry, the paid for entry, was Dell Computers, actually. Dell has applied for a trademark on cloud computing. And so each time we use that phrase today, if somebody could just put a dollar in the cup on that table over there, we can take up a collection for Dell because I think they need the money. The second thing that you get, the free result, the unpaid for result, is a Wikipedia entry, which I think tells you that people are thirsty for the definition, because if you're getting Wikipedia as your first unpaid result, it means people want to know how it's defined. So at the risk of some tedium, I'm going to read to you the Wikipedia definition, because I think it's actually very good. It's a little over thorough, which Wikipedia is. Maybe one of you can edit this at the end of this session, but I want to read it out loud. Cloud computing literally means internet-based development and use of computer technology. It is a style of computing where IT-related capabilities are provided as a service using internet technologies to multiple external customers. It allows users to access technology-enabled services without knowledge of, expertise with, nor control over the technology infrastructure that supports them. That bears repeating. It allows users to access technology-enabled services without knowledge of, expertise with, nor control over the technology infrastructure that supports them. And it goes on and on, and I'll read a little bit more. Resources being accessed are typically owned and operated by a third-party provider on grids in data center locations. Consumers typically purchase computing capacity on demand and are not generally concerned with the underlying technologies used to achieve the increase in server capacity. I think that's a pretty fair definition. People used to refer to the internet as the cloud. Now I think the cloud can be any third-party service that performs logic on a set of data and returns that data to a consumer or a customer. I also took a look at some Wall Street analyst reports in an effort to come up with a definition, and there are actually dozens of reports that have been written in the past, I'd say, 2 or 3 months about cloud computing. So every Wall Street brokerage house now has a position on cloud computing and who the hot companies are and so forth. And I liked one definition by Laura Letterman, who's an analyst at William Blair. She said, given that we're in the early stages of cloud computing, there are no set definitions explaining exactly what it is or the underlying components. IBM defines cloud computing as an emerging approach to shared infrastructure in which large pools of systems are linked together to provide IT services. And this is the key part. Users typically are not aware of the underlying technologies used to provide the services, only that the resources they wish to purchase are available over the internet, the backbone of the cloud. And I think that that's a really fair definition. So what to answer Tim's marketing request, what Salesforce.com does is it helps salespeople, marketing people, and help desk workers get access to information that their companies input into our servers, into our database, is processed in our data center, and then returned to them over the web. So that's what we do. So we fit sort of squarely in the definition of cloud computing. And if you step all the way back, I think that the history of meeting a lot of different human needs and wants is the history of moving from sort of independence and reliance on yourself or the individual or one small family unit to provide those wants and needs, and moving to interdependence and reliance on groups of individuals. So, you know, there are lots of examples of this, but to me, the economics of most complex and capital-intensive needs, such as the need for power in this building or the need for sewage or water and so forth, drive them to be met by a shared services model. So when you build a building today, you don't need to build a power plant next to it. Now you might if you want to go off the grid or you want alternative energy or you want to invest your dollars in that way, but generally speaking, you're probably buying your services, your water, your power, and so forth from some provider who specializes in providing those. So all of these companies operate as utilities because they're realizing the efficiencies of scale and they're putting complex processes and operations into the hands of experts. So if you run a university, you're not an expert in providing power or providing water or sewage. You want to focus on educating people. That's what you do best. There are a lot of benefits to shared services, right? The first is that the services exist at all, right? It's hard to build your own power plant or your own leach field. The second is that the services are relatively reliable. And the third is that usually they're relatively cheap. There are some drawbacks, and I think that we're going to talk more about the drawbacks here today because we're surrounded by lawyers, and I'm one. And the drawbacks include, first of all, that you've got to pay a fee to someone, right? It's not free. You can't sort of figure it out and do it yourself. Secondly, you lose control over the services themselves, so you have dependence on others that you didn't have before. Third, there's a loss of privacy about data and the metadata, even more importantly, maybe, of your life. And by metadata, I mean very simply data about data. So when you use a service, you become part of the data of that service. So PG&E knows how much power we're using right now, right? And that's interesting to them. It may be very interesting to others over time. So if you apply this model to information technology, that's what gives you the understanding of what's going on here. Companies that don't specialize in information technology management have figured out that maybe it's better to outsource that. Maybe it's better to buy that from the cloud, which is really an amalgam of third-party providers of information technology services. So cloud computing is really the way to express that. Software as a service, it's sometimes called. Sometimes it's called on-demand computing. So I'll ask my panelists to chip in here in a second, but given these drawbacks, the fees that you pay, the loss of control, the dependency that these shared services create, and the loss of privacy, the slow pitch down the middle of the plate to both of you, I think, is do we need to regulate this? Is this something that existing regulations can handle? Or is this something so new, so groundbreaking, and so different in its paradigm that we need to find some different way to regulate? Utilities, for example, have been regulated monopolies for decades, and they've been sanctioned as legal monopolies in many cases, and they're heavily regulated. Do we need some kind of similar scheme for cloud computing? And what are the issues that that would raise? That's my first question. I think my second question is a little bit more specific, which is, who ought to have access to all of the data and the metadata that's created when you outsource information technology or you outsource computing to a third party? And should there be some form of notice that's required if a law enforcement authority or if a if another third party seeks or gains access to that data. So those are my two big topics, and I would ask Jim, maybe if you can comment on the second one first, and we'll share a microphone with us.
Yeah, I think it's going to be easier to share the mic here. I would start by answering that question by taking your the definitions of cloud computing that you offered and trying to simplify them and boil them down. And in a really arguably oversimplified way, my view of cloud computing is any data storage or processing that does not occur locally, anything that does not occur on the laptop or the local computer that might be owned by an institution, but anything that takes place outside of the home, outside of the office. The key words and the definitions that were read, I think, are third party and server, that it is taking information and putting it into the hands of a third party. And when you think about it, this is one of, to my mind, one of the inexorable directions of technology today. I've previously written and talked about what I see as six sort of dominant technological trends that are fundamentally changing the privacy equation at the very least, and other things as well. What I would simply call storage, cloud computing, the dramatically lowered cost of information storage, in the case of Gmail, of course, free storage, advertising supported, but free, essentially unlimited storage of email. Just briefly, the others are search and its centrality to the way we find information, location awareness, and the growing ubiquity of location-aware devices, our cell phones being number one, of course, identity and the huge revolution that's underway in identity creation and management, the proliferation of sensing devices, and the interoperability of all this data, which allows you to take geotag data and add it with storage capabilities and facial recognition and storage of your photographs. And of these, arguably, the most significant is the growth of third-party storage services, in which category I put a whole range of things that wouldn't necessarily fall within the strict definition of cloud computing. Obviously, Flickr and other online photo storage services, literally taking the photographs out of the shoeboxes, off of the laptop, and putting them onto the server. Huge benefits in terms of sharing, arguably benefits in terms of backup and security of those photographs. Someone actually less likely to lose them with Flickr than you would if you tried to maintain them all yourself. All of my travel records are all conveniently stored for me on Expedia, all of my past trips. If you take a look at Gmail, the other Google Apps services, Google, for example, has a search service that allows you to search for information on your own computer and allows you to search across computers. So if you have two computers, one at work, one at home, you have information stored on it. From your work computer, you can search information on your home computer. Wow, how do they do that? Well, they've taken all that you have taken, all of the information from your home computer and all of the information from your office computer, and you have uploaded it to the Google servers. So taking it off of the laptop, out of the home, out of the office, and putting it on the server of a third party. Now, this, and you look at things, a whole host of developments, and you could even put social networking in this category of taking various categories of information, no longer hosting them exclusively on your laptop in a peer-to-peer kind of model, but storing them with Facebook or MySpace or another social network service. Now, there are four fundamental sort of dichotomies in our law of privacy, particularly as it relates to governmental access, that are completely undermined by this set of developments. We have tended to favor very highly in our law data in transit. So going back to Katzenberger and the Fourth Amendment, reasonable expectation of privacy in your communications, wiretap back, super warrant requirement, very high standard for governmental access to data in transit. Once your data reaches storage, it is less protected under some interpretations of the Constitution. That is when it is stored not with your on your laptop, not in your computer, not on your any portable device, but stored in the network, protection falls off. Data stored in the home, relatively highly protected, of course. Data stored with a third party, less protected. Content data is relatively highly protected. So the content of your email is relatively highly protected. The information about your email, the metadata or transactional data, which can be revealing and to some extent is becoming more revealing, less protected. Constitutionally, zero protection under the Fourth Amendment. And then generally what is private has been relatively highly protected, whereas what is public, what is exposed to public view, has tended to be not protected at all or protected very little. And now, of course, we have blurring between public and private. A lot of what occurs in public is now captured and stored by third parties. And so these critical lines are blurring. Now, at some level, we still have a pretty strong set of privacy protections, again, for data in transit. There are obviously compelling governmental interests at stake in accessing any and all information, information either in the home or in the hands of a third party. There's no absolute protection for that information. The question that we only have to argue about is the standard for governmental access to that data. Huge concerns, obviously, in terms of terrorism, identity theft and fraud online, child online protection, et cetera, which create a huge interest in having a ways for the government to get this information. And while I don't know that the technology itself needs to be regulated, to answer the question that David posed of should this be regulated, I think the market drivers are very powerful. I think what we need to do is we need to have clear rules for and strong rules for the privacy protection of this data. I think by and large those rules should be technology neutral. By and large, they should be a business model and platform neutral. I think by and large, the content versus non-content distinction remains a valid one and will probably, I think, be a continuing feature of our law in this area. But right now, think of your typical email if you use Gmail. As you are composing that email on your laptop, and let's say you are typing in your house, for example, one legal standard applies to, let's say, the government use of a keystroke logger in order to capture that. Or let's say the email is unsent. I don't actually know what is the status technologically in Google of an email that you've composed but not sent. But let's assume that you've got a document, an attachment. The attachment on your laptop is protected by the Fourth Amendment. Your email and the attachment in transit are protected not only by the Fourth Amendment, but by the super warrant, so to speak, standard of Title III, which requires somewhat more stringent protections than apply to a mere warrant. The email, once it reaches the intended recipient, is subject to the Fourth Amendment, although obviously the intended recipient can disclose it under no compulsion if they want to voluntarily. While the email sits on Google's server unread, it is subject to a, it falls back to the warrant standard. Once it is read in every circuit except the Ninth, it is subject to another standard. Once it is more than 180 days old, it falls arguably, although now subject to some constitutional question, into another standard. And the transactional data associated with that communication is subject to yet another standard. And it's different whether it's in transit or in storage. Actually, that's an odd example of which the transactional data in storage is more protected than the transactional data in transit. Now, David was saying that one of the elements of cloud computing is that the users are unaware of the underlying technology. I think it's fair to say that the users are unaware of the legal rules governing cloud computing and governing this flow of data. The chart that would spell out what are the legal rules, we actually put together that chart at CDT, and it is a patchwork, simply put, it's a patchwork. Now, at some level, different kinds of data will always be entitled to different rules, but I think as I see this market inexorably moving in the direction of cloud computing, of storages, that, services that occur not on the laptop but in the network, it is time for, I think, Congress and the courts to revisit some of the distinctions that have guided the law so far. Critical to preserve the government's access to the information. We haven't even touched upon civil litigate access, and we haven't even touched upon the rights and limitations that apply to the service providers who handle this information. We can get to those. But just in terms of the government has to have access to this information. I think that right now, the sort of crazy quilt of laws does not well serve the service providers. Government is sort of used to it, but I think we'd have to admit that it's a crazy quilt, and it does not serve, I think, the privacy interests of the users.
So I think that's very interesting. I want to get back to the government revisiting, or Congress revisiting, the notion in light of cloud computing. But I want to, and by the way, thank you for bringing up the Fourth Amendment, because after this morning, I was beginning to think that the first was the only amendment to the Constitution, but apparently there is more to it than that. But I wanted to ask Matt, do you feel hamstrung by this sort of patchwork of standards that you are subject to when you try to go out and get information in as part of your job enforcing the law?
No, I would not say that we feel hamstrung. It is an extra step that needs to be contemplated, and it is some extra process that needs to be gone through. And would it be convenient to have one spot where all the standards for governmental access to either the metadata or the content is contained? Yes, that would be convenient. However, over time, as the technology improves, that would be amended, and you know what, we'll be in the same situation as we're in now, and even if we revamp the laws totally. I did want to just stress the, in my experience, really the major issue, the new issue to individuals and that affects individual rights is not so much governmental access to these items, because really the framework for governmental access to, and as Jim was talking about, mainly electronic communications, there's a lot of other things that come into play as well. That framework is pretty well known. It's tweaked every now and then. Jim mentioned I'll call it an aberration that the Ninth Circuit is out of step, and that comes from a case called Theophile v. Fowrey Jones. And you'll see how, because of that case, the Ninth Circuit treats the contents of email slightly different, actually quite a bit differently for a portion of them than the other circuits. And so I can tell you as a reality what ends up happening is, since the major servers of email, and Yahoo, Hotmail, Google, etc., are all in the Ninth Circuit, In effect, the Ninth Circuit has just set the law for the country. And I certainly believe that in the next year or two, that'll end up in the Supreme Court, and they will make an ultimate decision on whether Theophile survives. You might think that being, you know, that Theophile, because Theophile puts an extra burden on me, on law enforcement, that I'd be dead set against it, but it's a very interesting decision. You should read it if you haven't. I don't have cite memorized, maybe one of these guys do, but or they might have it. But it is a very interesting decision, and it really covers some ground, maybe incorrectly at the end of the day, but it covers some ground that needed to be covered, and I think it'll end up benefiting us at the end of the day. But I did want to stress that the Fourth Amendment, there's a paradigm that we can compare this to, and that's in the telephone communication world, in which all these same sort of players are involved. In other words, search warrants for certain items, subpoenas for certain items, maybe some transactional items, and then ultimately a Title III or a wiretap request if you want to capture content in real time. The major difference between emails and telephone communications is that generally telephone communications do not exist after the real time is over. You may have a record of the call, you may have an origination number and a termination number and a time of the call, but by and large, assuming there's no answering service or answering machine that's recording it, most telephone communications, if you're not capturing them in real time with a wiretap, they're gone forever. And that doesn't happen, as we know, with email. Email is going to be there. Probably it's the exact reverse. It's always going to be there, unless you take special steps to get rid of it. So as Jim mentioned, you know, Title III's wiretap are required to capture in real time emails that are transmitted. It was just a case out of, I'm sorry I don't recall the name of it, but I just read it yesterday, out of a district court in Los Angeles, which, first time I read something to the effect that emails, as they go through the internet and they go through various hops, and they may stay at a certain hop for a period of time. It might only be a millisecond or it might be a second, but this court determined that that hop, if it was captured at that hop, it was no longer in transit. It was in storage, and these different rules, which are enunciated in ECBA, which is under 18 U.S.C. 2703, which lays out the various requirements for governmental access to these things. I don't think that's going to survive. I mean, it's a district court decision. I think that certainly the Ninth Circuit is going to afford more protection. So while there is somewhat of a patchwork of different laws, it's not inventing the wheel again. There's a paradigm out there that works, that is well known, and as the technology develops, it keeps getting compared back to that. And it allows us to proceed forward. I would want to throw out, and perhaps we'd get to this at any point during the day here, but especially to the industry people, one of the trends that I see, and I've been really involved in cybercrime, or actually investigating cybercrime, I should say, since for over 10 years, from really when nobody knew what ECBA was, when if we did a search warrant on a computer, the judge would immediately call us up and call me up. It didn't matter who was doing it. And the judges and magistrates were really intimidated by the technology and by the newness of that. And now we're at a point in time when my office in San Jose, which is a branch office of the Northern District, we do literally hundreds of requests from foreign countries a year for email information. It may be content, it may be subscriber info, it may be logs or things like that, and that's the kind of, it just shows how familiar and how well-trodden these paths are getting. But I did want to throw out to the, especially the industry people here, what I see in, as a trend in computer crime, especially in the Northern District here, especially in Silicon Valley, is a movement away from what we traditionally saw, which was hacking, and as somewhat a movement away from copyright infringement, although we're still seeing a large amount of that, especially coming in from overseas, and we're prosecuting that. But what we're seeing more and more is the theft of trade secrets, especially theft of trade secrets, which is done to benefit a foreign entity, and that's economic espionage. We see that a lot, and it is a very difficult crime to investigate, and it's very difficult to prosecute. There are many legal issues, there's also many technological issues. One of the legal issues that crosses over is that the first thing, one of the elements we have to show in order to show a theft of trade secret is, did the company protect this item as a trade secret? What did they do? And we need to show their security development, their, how they handled it, maybe non-disclosure agreements, and so on and so forth. And so I think it's a real challenge for companies who may have an economic enticement to using cloud computing to develop trade secret or proprietary intellectual property. They may have an economic enticement for that, but you may be, as was mentioned earlier, subject to a little bit of loss of control. And where is that loss of control going to stand you when you want to turn around and either bring a civil case for a theft of a trade secret or come to law enforcement and say, hey, I want these individuals prosecuted. And you know, the first line of defense is, well, you have this stored in some sort of cloud computing process. So it's an interesting challenge. That has not been litigated, not that I know of. Most of the time, the economic espionage or trade secret cases that we do, companies are using sort of standalone or restricted networks to protect access to this. So I throw that out. If there's anybody who's handled any of that, I'd be interested to know.
I have a comment on that, and I guess, you know, I think that in our instance, and I think in the instance of most people in the industry, they would feel as though their intellectual property was protected by contract with the cloud computing company, right? So most companies that are going to buy cloud computing services, whether they buy them from us or buy them from Amazon or IBM or AT&T, announced yesterday that they were getting into the business, they would do it pursuant to a contract that would have confidentiality terms and that presumably would create an envelope of trade secret protection that then they could rely on and you could rely on similarly to sort of navigate your way through the thicket. But it's interesting that you bring that up because I see the flip side of it, which is we run a global business, and I think the number one or maybe number two objection by European prospects, prospective customers of ours, to buying from us is that your data centers are only located in the U.S., and we think that the U.S. Patriot Act enables the U.S. government to conduct industrial espionage on behalf of U.S. companies, and the paranoia around that has heightened in the past, let's say, 2 months, in the wake of Boeing getting back into the tanker contract and EADS, the European consortium, losing the tanker contract, or at least temporarily the bidding being reopened. And so their paranoia is very high. It's funny, I mean, I'm not as paranoid about losing my trade secrets, they're sort of more paranoid about theirs.
That's interesting. And just commenting further, we see a real issue for law enforcement with certainly, you know, overseas servers on of various types, and I assume there'll be overseas servers involving cloud computing, which will restrict our access. I can't tell you the number of cases where there's a hack into some online retailer or traditional retailer, and few hundred thousand credit card numbers are stolen, and we trace that back, and it goes to Ukraine. And that's it. That's the end of it. We have no cooperate, or it goes back to China, and we have no cooperation from the government, and we're unable to get access to the evidence, and it really restricts us a lot.
So we have a similar problem sort of in reverse, because we're always trying to convince global customers that it's okay to store your data here. But how would you feel about the regulatory framework if you understood that you could not get access to, say, Hotmail email accounts because they were all stored in some other jurisdiction that did not have some kind of comity or treaty? Pick a jurisdiction, but you know, I don't know the treaty structure all that well. But what if there were a country that where you could lawfully conduct business as a U.S. entity, and you could put all your servers there, you couldn't reach them? I mean, would you then advocate for some kind of change?
But wait a minute. I mean, the fact that every bit of Salesforce data is on a server in China doesn't do any good if the U.S. government comes to you with a subpoena, because you're going to turn over that data before you go to jail.
That's probably true. That's probably true. There may be instances where we wouldn't. There may be instances where we would say.
But the fact of it being in China is irrelevant to whether you'll comply with the subpoena or not.
No, it may be very relevant.
In
because
what way?
We may feel as though we're complying with the laws of both jurisdictions in which we operate. So, in other words, a U.S. subpoena is served on a U.S. parent, maybe all the data is held by the subsidiary. And the treaties might govern, and the treaties might say it's okay to do business and have all the data in China. Now, chances are that's not going to happen, but it could.
Well, although here, I think in this case here, the chances the Chinese law would prohibit... But again... That's an interesting. Right, I agree. That's an interesting question.
It is.
The Chinese government.
Let me just give a real world because we run into this not fairly often, but occasionally. And in reality, what happens when we have, it's usually the opposite. We have a subsidiary here, and the parent is in another country, and that's why they're sending their data to the other country. However, what you're having is, even though they may be storing the data there, it's passing through servers in the U.S. It's being stored here for a period of time, and in reality, we can usually get, unless it's something that's ancient, years old, we'll get a good bite at the data and get a good picture of it.
I think that is the reality. Tim, did you have a comment or a question?
I do, please.
I tend to be kind of loud, but for the benefit of the others. Thank you, David, for bringing up about the so-called Patriot Act problem. And it's actually not just a theoretical issue here. Now, we've had two Canadian provinces go on record and say that none of their governmental data can be stored in the United States for exactly that reason.
Yep.
So it's not just theoretical anymore. All three of you are looking externally with regards to access to the data, and I think there's another view here too that I'd be interested in hearing you address, and that's of course the internal access to the data as well. And one of the common concerns that you hear from prospective customers is with regards to the privileged access problem. How is it that you assure that you don't have a DBA or sysadmin who's got access to the keys of the kingdom, because he's got access to everybody's problems. He's selling the Boeing data to EDS because it's located in the same server farm, sort of thing. So how would you address that? And particularly with regards to, David, you brought up regulation at the beginning. One of the things that you hear the Final Four say is there's no good way to audit this data right now when it's sitting in an environment like that. So is regulation therefore required to somehow, I'll say, extend the ability to comply with GLBA or Sarbanes-Oxley into the cloud?
I think it's definitely possible, and I'll leave it to the gentleman on my left and my right to answer that question, because it may be against my employer's interest for me to answer that question. But I will say that that is a very real concern of all of our customers, right, is who internally can have access to it. And some of them impose requirements on us that make it somewhat painful for us, that make us move people around internally, move employees, and take away some of the keys to the kingdom. You know, the city and county of San Francisco obviously just had that problem, right, with one of their DBAs who locked them out for, I think, a couple days. That happened in the skyscraper next door to our headquarters, and so we were very keen on getting that resolved. But it is a vexing problem, and I'll leave it to these two gentlemen to comment on whether they think regulation would be welcome or necessary there.
Well, I can tell you that there is, in some view, regulation already in place. I mean, if a sysadmin was doing that, I mean, that's a crime. So it's being regulated by the criminal laws. If he's obtaining data in excess of his authorization, I mean, that in fact is and he's obtaining it and then he's transferring it to somebody else. I mean, that's a crime, but I don't really think that's getting at what you're talking about. Going back also to a little bit what was said earlier about whether the customers actually know who has access to the information. So here's another thing. I think that companies themselves need to do a better job of making sure that people who are using their services know what happens. Now, maybe not technologically exactly what happens, but if one company is dealing with another sophisticated company, those companies should be aware of what exactly is going on with the data and who has access to it and be able to negotiate who has access to it. Tell you the truth, I don't know that any regulatory scheme would really get down to that level.
Just two thoughts. Obviously, you're right to say that the insider threat to data is usually the number one threat. Now, in the case, I think the San Francisco case was actually not a contractor, but a city employee. What's also interesting, of course, is he was put in jail for failing to give over the key. He had locked up that he hadn't stolen the data. He had locked up the data. He was put in jail and ultimately gave the mayor, literally, went to the jail cell and got the key. The guy will get out of jail now. But I think that for the answer to your question is that for a lot of people, outsourcing the data quality, the data storage function will improve security, because you're also outsourcing your security, basically. So rather than having to train, supervise, monitor your own employees, you basically have Salesforce monitoring their employees, doing the background checks, doing the supervision, reviewing the audit logs, doing the anomaly detection, et cetera, in terms of looking for the unauthorized access. So for a number of people, they can get far better service with the outsourcer than they can in-house, just because they're not experts at computer security. There will be some people for whom letting it out of your hands might result in a diminution in that. And that will be one of the trade-offs that people will always make, as to whether you keep it in-house versus outsourced. To a large extent, I mean, maybe that distinction disappears in a networked environment, since you're going to have remote employees accessing the data anyhow, and you may have partner sharing in certain kinds of data, et cetera. I think that certainly the FTC, as a regulatory matter, the FTC has nudged into the data security world. They are evolving, I think, at least for personally identifiable data, at least for sort of data about consumers. They've certainly adopted a rule that it is an unfair or deceptive trade practice not to protect data of your customers, and that applies equally whether you are the consumer-facing entity or a third party providing back-end services. And then you've got, obviously you have contract, and so people are going to, A, a powerful purchaser of outsourcing services will use their contracting power to impose on the vendor additional responsibilities if they, or else they'll just spend the money to build it in-house.
Yeah, do you want to follow up, Tim?
So both of those are, from Jim's answer, methods are both after the fact, if you will. And I'm really looking for how do we do this in a little bit more proactive of a manner.
And so let me come straight back to the moderator then. Since your company has this challenge right now, there's no clear way how to do this, and therefore you get customers who want a one-off, and you have some customers who are more savvy about maybe some of the contract provisions they negotiate, maybe they're more savvy about the audit requirements they place on you, that sort of thing. Right. So my question for you then is regulation really necessary to, in fact, enable the cloud computing environment to take away some of these uncertainties so that businesses, especially large enterprises, let's leave aside the SMBs for just a moment because of the issues that Jim raised with regards to perhaps don't have enough staff or enough talented staff, don't have the size, et cetera, but for large enterprises. So is regulation actually necessary to enable the industry to take away the uncertainties so that you as a provider, Salesforce.com, Google, the others, know exactly what the standards are for audit, for security, et cetera?
I personally and professionally don't think so. And that sounds a little too pat, so I'll explain myself. I think that you sort of are the company you keep. And so small and medium-sized businesses ride along with larger businesses when they outsource services. So for example, payroll, right, which is one of the most confidential services that you can get. Virtually no company does its own payroll. I mean, General Motors might. I don't know. They've got 100,000 employees or more. Well, last I checked. But very few companies outsource. Very few companies insource payroll. They almost all outsource it to ADP or Meridian or the other payroll providers. And that's probably the most confidential information you have at some level. It's certainly very personal information. Very, very few companies go audit ADP and say, I want to make sure that the spreadsheets that I send you each week or every 2 weeks to pay my employees are handled properly and so forth, because they're relying on the reputation of ADP as a payroll provider with a 100-year good history of providing services and not having significant security breaches, at least not that we know of, and so forth. So, for example, Salesforce.com outsources its payroll to ADP. We rely on their reputation. They happen to be a customer of ours, and when they became a customer of ours, it was actually 5 years ago, they did a deep dive on us because we were a relatively small, privately held company. We were not a publicly reporting company. There wasn't a lot of information out there about us. They did a deep dive and audit on us because they wanted to make sure that their data was going to be secure. Similarly, we get that same deep dive from banks and brokerage houses, large financial institutions, and others. And thousands of other businesses sort of free ride on their audits. I think if you've got enough customers, if you've got critical mass, the bigger customers are going to hold your feet to the fire with respect to data security and privacy of their data and so forth. And the many other customers who don't have the resources to do those kinds of investigations or do that due diligence will ride along with, you know, in my case, the Citigroups, the Merrill Lynches, the ADPs, the Ciscos, et cetera, who are our big customers, who are the ones, you know, in our boxer shorts investigating us on a daily basis. So I personally believe in that model, and I professionally believe in it as well. I don't think the regulators, with all due respect, are going to do as good a job as the folks whose data it actually is protecting. That's just my opinion. You two may have other opinions.
You know, I essentially agree with that. If we're talking on the security side.
I think the benefit of that is that there's no regulatory scheme that could be variable enough and flexible enough to really address each circumstance, whereas every different customer that comes to Salesforce and meets with David is going to have a slightly different angle, and they're going to be experts on that angle, and they're going to have slightly different security needs, and they're going to be experts on that need. Now, I will argue against this same position because if you're in law enforcement long enough, you realize everything is great until it's not great. And there will come a time when exactly what you're talking about will come to pass, and has. You know, we've seen it with, I was talking about credit card hacks and various other things. It will come to pass. The question is whether the threat is so pervasive and so destructive of the marketplace that it then forces lawmakers to want to get involved. And that's kind of above my pay grade, so don't know.
Questions? Well, if I could ask a question.
No. It's actually more of a statement. I think what we're trying to gather from this conversation, gather from everything you've said about cloud computing, and what does that mean for Washington policymakers, and what does that mean for regulators, and how do they get their arms around it? Because it takes years to start, for concepts to start penetrating the consciousness of a member of Congress who may not even use a laptop computer. And we're trying to figure, well, what does this mean? And I would ask all of you to say, if you had an elevator conversation with a member of Congress, well, what cloud computing is and what does it mean? What is the fundamental paradigm shift? What would you say if you're in the elevator on the way up to a vote? And just in general, the cloud computing and why it's different heretofore.
From my perspective, from the CDT consumer perspective, I would say that it is taking information out of your home or office and off of your laptop where it's fully protected by the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution and putting it on third-party servers where it is not fully protected by the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. And we, rather than stifling the trend of the technology, which has significant benefits, we need to adjust our laws to ensure that information is protected regardless of the business model or the technology by which it's stored.
I agree with that, and I would add to it a little bit of a twist, which is, I think the interesting thing to me is about cloud computing, among other things, is it produces huge heterogeneous data sets for the first time, really. So we know what people write, right? I mean, Google is, who called it an engine of intentions or something? It's, what you intend to buy, what you intend to visit, who you intend to meet, and so forth. And so these massive data sets, and they're very heterogeneous, they come in from all over the world, from many different users, are new for the first time. People don't understand how those data sets are going to be used. And there's a risk, right? The risk is that, all of a sudden the FBI decides that every left-handed Anabaptist who owns a Buick Regal is a mass murderer because of some pattern matching program that they've got. There are lots of other risks too, and I think you sort of have to watch those big data sets get bigger and bigger, and the metadata that's about the data that are in the data sets is also very interesting. And I think sort of watching those evolve and figuring out how they're used and who the trusted parties are who will be allowed access to them is really kind of where the action is for me.
Well, I would just reiterate my comment that while cloud computing has certain challenges and certain nuances that didn't exist before, the paradigm for a governmental access in a law enforcement sense has been laid, and it needs to be continued along the same path, maybe organized a little bit more, but allowed to proceed so that we can sort of prevent this from becoming a tool of illegality more than it already is, actually.
That's interesting. One thing, the reason I asked the question is because I read a couple of days ago about Brad Stone from New York Times, who writes the Bits column or Bytes column, and he was talking about cloud computing in the context of filtering. And this one company in the Silicon Valley used it for filtering out inappropriate material from employees, pornography, restricting access to different websites during the course of the day. And you can use your Facebook, you can modify your Facebook profile at work at lunchtime and no other time. He was saying that's the benefit of this cloud computing filtering and employee management system. It's in the cloud, he was saying. I don't know if it really it really is in the cloud, but I think what he's saying is, or at least this company is trying to sell the idea that you have this these massive data sets in a cloud context, and you also have massive computing power thrown at them, orders of magnitude more power than we've seen before. And because of that, they can start picking out inappropriate material, managing content, finding viruses, finding pornography much more easily than maybe an internet service provider right now trying to do deep packet inspection as all this data is moving through their pipe. As the data is resting and floating and moving around the cloud, the computational power will allow it to do a lot more things that a member of Congress may want to have done. Security, pornography, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I was really struck by that.
And I think there are two different issues that you've raised, which I at least see as conceptually different legally. One of which is service provider responsibility, which is getting us back to the earlier panel of service provider either ability or responsibility to access and use this information. I think David referenced what I would call the sort of principle of interoperability, which is it's becoming easier and easier to match data and mash data across platforms, across applications, across different purposes for which it was initially generated. And we're now, partly because of that, partly because of the computing power, we're seeing service providers being able to do more with data. And then the question is, will they be mandated to do more with data? That's, I think, one of the issues posed by deep packet inspection.
Well, in the past, and even now with deep packet inspection, there's a real good argument to say, well, it's a burden, and B, data is moving so quickly through our pipes. If we have to inspect every bit, every packet, it's going to slow up the experience for the user. But when we're talking about, as you said, huge heterogeneous data sets that are floating out there, and then you're able to throw the computational power at that, you can accomplish a lot more things without too much additional effort. And I think that's a paradigm shift.
And I think, I'm not sure that I would be in the position of either prohibiting the private sector or the government from taking advantage of that. The only thing we're talking about, which is all it's ever really worth talking about, are the standards for being able to do that. And on the corporate side, you get down to questions like notice and user control. And on the government side, you get to questions of the Fourth Amendment warrant-based paradigm versus lower standards of access. And you get also on the government side to the question of notice. The government wants to come to me and serve me with a search warrant. Not only does it require that probable cause finding by the judge, but I'm given notice contemporaneous with the search in almost all cases. Whereas if the government can go to a third party service provider, not only can the government often get that same data under a much lower standard, sometimes with a mere subpoena issued without any prior judicial approval, it can also get it without notice to the record subject. Often the data holder is either prohibited or not prohibited from giving notice or not required to give notice and therefore will not go through the extra step of giving notice. So again, I think what we need to do is to develop a set of rules, which we do not adequately have now. Look at that email as it passes through all those different legal regimes in the course from being composed, to being delivered, to being stored. We do not yet have that legal structure adequately in place.
Any additional questions? Back here.
I think we're all familiar with the telecom providers cooperating with the government in the wireless, warrantless wiretapping. And so hearing this panel, I'm concerned that the same thing could occur with cloud computing. that the government could come to a Salesforce.com or an IBM or whoever is the cloud computing service provider and say, hey, I want this data from company XYZ because we think that they're in league with someone. Can I get the panel to comment on that? Is that feasible? Is that something that has happened, could happen? What's your take on that, please?
I'll kick it off. It has happened. It can happen. It can happen in old world utilities as well. Jim and I were talking before this morning about the case of Ed Jew, the San Francisco supervisor who resigned after there were allegations made that he did not live in the district that he represented. And part of the government's proof was PG&E records, right? He never turned on the light switch or flushed his toilet or did anything that needed an old world utility, and they got those records from the utility, not from Ed Jew himself. And so I think that that is very much a part of I think the analog, not to use analogies for everything, but I think the analog holds in the cloud as well. It can and does happen.
Right, I would agree with that. I mean, in circumstances that would give rise to that, we would seek to obtain that evidence. The real question is not whether the evidence is there and whether it's obtained, but what is the legal process that's required for that? And in an example, as David just mentioned, it would be a simple subpoena to PG&E saying, hey, we need this information, and it will come back and say, whatever, 0 kilowatts used, and you think he uses candlelight or something. But that's really the critical point in a situation like this is what is the legal process utilized, and there are many of them, many mechanical legal mechanisms that can be used to gain access to the evidence, and sometimes there may be a push one way or the other, with it be it a court case or be it a new statute that opens things up a little bit. So,
I mean, what happened in the warrantless wiretapping case was that we have an administration which has a radical view of executive power and believed that it was not bound by the law, by the statute, and went outside of that statute. The companies in that case went along with it. I think it may be harder for companies in the future to do so, just because of the negative publicity that those companies endured. I think that I happen to believe, the CDT believes, that the granting of immunity in that case was a mistake, precisely because of the factor that you can't have a system in which the consequences for following the rules and the consequences for not following the rules are the same. But that's
because those telecom companies got off the hook. The service providers, the cloud computing service providers, might take that as a precedent and be very cooperative to a government that's abusing its power.
They would have, if it got revealed, then they would have to end up being like the telephone companies and engaging in a massive lobbying campaign in order to get their immunity. But I think even the telephone companies would probably not behave the same way if asked again. Excuse me?
That's somewhat reassuring.
Well, I think what we really need is we need a president of whatever party who says he's going to follow the laws passed by Congress.
Now we have another question.
You mentioned the role of a deep packet inspection, and the FCC on Friday just said that what Comcast was doing with regard to some of its quote-unquote network management and blocking peer-to-peer was not reasonable network management. And I think some of these actions, I'm arguing in an article that I'm writing, are also a violation of the Federal Trade Commission Act as unfair competition and unfair and deceptive trade practices. But it does make me wonder, with ISP control over the packets going through their gateway, does ISP control really limit the ability right now of cloud computing?
It hasn't hampered us. There are many ISPs that are competitive. you know, we buy at commercially reasonable rates, and because we believe that our customers, and we, in fact, we contractually require our customers to abide by the laws of the jurisdictions in which they operate, we don't think of our customers as rogue or engaging in any criminal activity or tortious conduct, because we prohibit that by contract. If it's brought to our attention, obviously we have to investigate it. I'm not, from a commercial standpoint, sort of representing quote unquote the cloud computing industry here. I'm not as concerned about that. I think if you are, if what you're doing is sort of offering raw data processing power, the way Amazon is, the way IBM and AT&T purport to, today, you may have greater concerns, though AT&T is also an ISP, so they've kind of got both ends covered, I suppose. Others may have different opinions, but for us, it's not really an issue, because we, you know, the things that we're doing and what our customers are engaged in, we believe is lawful commercial activity.
Well, if I can just take this microphone very quickly. I want to thank the panel, David, Matthew, and Jim, for an interesting discussion, illuminating. Obviously, the definitions are broad, and we'll be hearing a lot more about cloud computing during the next Congress and the next administration, so I'm trying to get up to speed on it. If I can, without applause, thank the panel, and then quickly go to Eric Goldman to wrap things up, and I personally want to thank Eric and his team at Santa Clara for hosting co-hosting this conference. Did a terrific job, and we're proud honored to partner with you.
Yeah, terrific. Oops. Sorry, terrific, and thanks to all of you for coming today. This is really, I think, an important set of conversations to have, and we're thrilled to be able to have it with with Tim's team and with all the panelists today. So we have a lot of people to thank. We could spend some time with that. I do want to thank Kyra and Cindy, who have provided all the back-end support here, as well as Nick from Tim's team, who helped us get us through today. We have a reception right now, so the conversation isn't over. We will give you a little more food and libations to help fuel that conversation. So thank you again to all of you for spending your time today, and I'll see you outside.